I mean, I've always been interested in kind of the basic unbreachable gap between people and how we spend our lives, most of us, trying to connect with other people and to cross that gap.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with novelist and travel writer Maggie Shipstead, whose newest novel, Great Circle, is a stunning history of two women, an actress in present-day Hollywood and a pilot, an unrelentless devotee of the sky. Maggie Shipstead is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels Seating Arrangements, Astonish Me, and Great Circle. She lives in Los Angeles. Maggie, welcome to The Right Question.
Thanks for having me, Lauren.
Maggie, there are two main perspectives in Great Circle. Hadley Baxter, who is an actress in present day or 2014 era Hollywood, and Marion Graves, who's a pilot whose life is laid out pretty painstakingly in the book from her birth. She and her twin brother, Jamie, are born in 1914. In a chapter about Marion, who at this point in this chapter has left a previous life behind, you write, "So maybe she's not quite herself again. Not that she's foolish enough to think there's one fixed version of a person." Maggie, which version of yourself are you today?
I don't know. I'm not sure we can ever know what version we are in the present. I think we do a lot of sort of reconstructive narrative making about ourselves in retrospect. I think as people were drawn to the idea of cause and effect and to stringing things along in ways that make sense to us. So I think I'll be able to look back at myself now and maybe a year, maybe longer, and have an idea. But, you know, as it is in the present moment, I feel like I am the person I've always been, which is, of course, not quite true. And that's what I was trying to say in the book.
You know, this question, this quote that I just read is part of a chapter about Alaska in Great Circle. Would you mind reading an excerpt from that chapter?
I would love to. In this part of Marion Graves's life, she has fled to Alaska sort of in search of anonymity and in search of opportunities to fly. It's still a very wild place as it is today. And so this is in 1935 when she is 21 years old and she's gotten a job flying cargo. 11 days into 1935, Amelia Earhart becomes the first person to fly solo from Honolulu to Oakland. "Stars hang outside the cockpit window near enough to touch," she writes. 10,000 people surround her after she lands and her red Lockheed Vega seems to wallow on a human sea. "I wouldn't want to fly over that much ocean," says Marion's boss, the man with the scarred lip. He's not one for posturing, and she likes him for it. Most of the other guys say they'd do it too if they had the kind of money Earhart has from her husband and from smiling for pictures and putting her name on malted milk tablets and luggage sets and whatever else. They act like her flights somehow don't count, aren't real. Marion is a real Alaska flyer now. She shuttles between towns and what pass for cities, out to bush villages and encampments and lonely cabins, bringing mail, food, fuel, dogs, dog sleds, newspapers, motorcycles, explosives, wallpaper, tobacco, doorknobs, you name it. She flies men out into the backcountry who strike it rich, and others who drown or freeze or get eaten by bears or blow themselves up. She flies corpses wrapped in canvas sacks. Once a corpse smells so bad she lashes it to the wing. Once a woman gives birth in her plane. Once she lands on the frozen surface of the Chukchi Sea to rescue the passengers of a ship locked in ice. Somewhere she picks up a Russian word, polynya, for the patches of open water in the sea ice where whales come to breathe. The landscape is secretive and harsh and impossibly immense, and she borrows some of its inscrutability for its herself, its disinterest in human goings-on. Unfriendliness is another form of camouflage. In winter, the sun rises in the south. Far enough north, it never rises at all. She wears long johns and wool sweaters, and over those a reindeer hide suit. At first glance, you wouldn't even peg her as a woman, would only see a shaggy block. But she carries a knife and a pistol for when second and third glances happen. Rough country. Cold is murder on planes. Fuel tanks freeze, hydraulic pumps don't work, rubber tires and gaskets turn brittle and leaky, instruments quit. On cold mornings, she lights a fire pot under the engine, puts a canvas tarp over it to keep the heat in, watches like a hawk because the gas or oil or tarp itself might ignite at any moment and sometimes does. She's put out more fires than she can remember. She's broken propellers, skis, a wing, flown with sprays of leaking gasoline fanning out behind her. Once, what she thought was solid ground had turned out to be marsh and splashed up at her as the wheels touch, flipping the plane. She was all right, hanging upside down in her seat, mucky water running in under her head. A mule team had to come pull the plane out. Once, she flies to McCarthy, only knows she's to pick up a man and bring him back to Anchorage. He's waiting beside the airstrip in handcuffs. He's a minor, she's told. He raped another minor's wife. Fine, she says. She has them stow him in back with some bundled furs she's picked up. They cuff him to his seat. 15 minutes in the air, and she rolls the old junker plane tidily upside down. She figures if it breaks apart, at least she'll take him with her, but they come up right again. He's screaming, both his shoulders dislocated. Bad weather, she says when she delivers him under a bright blue sky. Got bumped around a bit. The story gets out, makes a man think twice before he tries to get close to her.
Why did you choose that excerpt to read?
I think it gives a bit of flavor for the kind of life she's leading and also a sense of the pacing of the book and the way sections like that one sort of move through time quickly. And just trying to give, yeah, a broader sense that in some ways goes beyond just the scope of this one life, which is really part of the major project of the book.
This idea, this statement that you just said, this one life, early on in the book, in a chapter written from Hadley's perspective, this Hollywood actress, she says of her uncle Mitch, who became her legal guardian after her parents died, coincidentally, in a plane crash, Mitch would say, "You only live once." He was the original YOLO guy. And like you said, one of the preoccupations of this book, one of the projects, one of the themes, is this question of living this life. What will you do with your one life? Maggie, why write at such length about this question? And how does that question operate or guide your life?
Well, it's funny. You know, I think when I start writing, I don't have sort of themes in mind. There's so not a sort of thematic agenda that I'm then building the plot to express. It's more that I start building the plot and then the themes sort of emerge. And so for me, I knew I wanted to write about a woman who had to be a pilot, who just knows in her soul she must be a pilot. And so then, given the era she's living in, so Marion Graves is born in 1914 and she learns to fly in Montana in the 20s, you know, what sort of obstacles would arise. And as it turns out, you know, she has to sort of endlessly defend her right to lead an unorthodox life from sort of these incursions. There's a lot of pressure to have a more domestic existence. There's some devil's bargain she has to make in order to be a pilot. And so it's just sort of evolved over the process of drafting the book that Marion has to be very conscious of what kind of life she wants to lead. And then the way Hadley connects to her is Hadley is so lost at the beginning of the book. And part of what she sees in Marion, and sort of like somebody looking at tarot cards or tea leaves, is she sees someone who knew what kind of life she wanted to lead. And to her, that it feels like there might be some sort of message in there for her. And for myself, you know, this has definitely been a question, particularly in the now almost 7 years since I started writing this book. I started the book in fall of 2014. I started travel writing in summer of 2015. And my life became also, like Marion's, just less domestic, less open to domesticity. I was always gone. 2019, I was out of the country for more than 100 days. And that had a toll, you know, like some of my, it's hard to maintain relationships and friendships when you're always gone. And I had to sort of decide for myself that that was a priority nonetheless.
You say that Marion had no choice. And that is, I think, you know, a statement that is repeated over and over. She just is trying, with questions kind of pointed at her, why a pilot? Why do you want to do this? You know, she can never quite articulate exactly why it is. She just had no choice but to do that. She can't explain this magnetism that she has. And like you just said, you haven't always been a travel writer, which often is accompanied by adventuring these trips. When did that version of yourself come alive, this want for adventure? And are you able to explain your why you're drawn to it?
Not always. And some of this too comes into play with people who are drawn to the high latitudes, the Arctic and the Antarctic. And it's often just something is in you and you want to go there and see these places. And kind of during the time I was writing this book, I went to Antarctica twice. I went to the Arctic 5 times. And other travelers would often be couples where one person is obsessed with that place and the other doesn't care. And they sort of have to go there as a compromise. But yeah, it was this question of why Marion would do something as dangerous as wanting to fly around the world north-south. And people make the point to her that like everything's been discovered. It's not about discovery. It's incredibly dangerous. It's a lot of trouble to go to then deliver yourself back to the place where you started, you know, when the horizon will just still be there leading to a new place. And kind of the most useful thing I read in the course of writing was in this book, The Ice Balloon by Alec Wilkerson, about a sort of failed attempt to cross the North Pole with a hot air balloon in the early part of the 20th century. And he's talking about these explorers and sort of the golden age of exploration and this question of why. And he says, you know, they would just have a vision of themselves doing this thing. And to them, the very obscurity of the vision was compelling and was a reason to do it. The fact that they didn't know why was to them like an actual reason. And I sort of put that into Marion. I think she couldn't really explain this urge, but sort of the mysteriousness of it is convincing to her in some strange way. And yeah, I can often slip into that. I'll hear about a place or I'll see a picture and I'll just know that I really want to go there. And I could never articulate like why that particular desolate wasteland speaks to me so strongly.
I want to talk about another preoccupation in the book. There are many instances where the boundaries and the edges between characters become very clear and hardened, very definitive. And that seems to be something that you're investigating. At one point, Hadley says, "It's not like you can really know that much about anyone anyway. No one sees most of what we do. No one knows more than a tiny fraction of what we think. And when we die, it all evaporates." And then in a later chapter, you write of Marion, why did she have this impulse to throw herself at boundaries, be flung back by them? And this preoccupation with not really knowing another person, with how much of a light life gets lost when one dies, where did that come from? Where did that idea come from? Was that something that, you know, just naturally sort of made its way into the narrative?
I think so. I mean, I've always been interested in kind of the basic unbreachable gap between people and how we spend our lives, most of us, trying to connect with other people and to cross that gap. And we can never entirely do it. I mean, of course, we find closeness and have intimate friendships and relationships and family connections, but we are always sort of stuck within ourselves and our just ongoing sort of thought life, the life we lead inside our minds. It's so invisible to everyone. You just really can't experience another person that way. And so I've always thought about that. And then one of sort of the things I thought about at the very beginning of starting to write the book was, of course, Amelia Earhart. You know, you say you're writing a book about a female pilot who disappears flying around the world, and people are like, oh, Amelia Earhart. And to me, I mean, I've been pretty adamant that I think there's almost no chance anything happened to her other than she crashed into the ocean and drowned. It's overwhelmingly likely. But because there were ways to sort of build a mystery around her disappearance and death, it's sort of taken on a significance that's different from just a dead person who was famous at a time and has sort of lived on. And I still don't feel like I quite have wrapped my mind around why that is. And you know, something I became aware of writing the book was that there were many other very famous female pilots at the time who were household names and people sort of followed their exploits. And Amelia Earhart's the only one who's really persisted in our consciousness. And I think some of it is that question of unknowability, because if you really try, you can come up with other versions of what happened to her than just a sort of quick drowning death in the ocean. And that has really sort of kept her alive, and there's sort of a blankness where the end of her life is.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with novelist and travel writer Maggie Shipstead, author of Great Circle. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So I want to talk about the perspectives in the book, the perspectives of Marion and Hadley. Hadley's chapters are written from the first person eye, and Marion's, while they follow her closely, and they're written, Marion's are written basically from an omniscient narrator's perspective, from the, you know, third person she. So how did you come to that decision, particularly when Marion's perspective and her narrative, her story is the dominant one in the book's, like, you know, 600 pages?
Yeah, I came to it with a lot of angst and a lot of second guessing. I mean, I don't think I questioned writing the bulk of the book in the third person, partly because that's what I usually use. My first two books are also in third person, with sort of varying degrees of closeness to the characters. And it's just the most flexible, you know, as you say, there's some omniscience that I sort of move in and out of. Sometimes it's very close to her. Sometimes it's, you know, takes a huge step away. And then Hadley's voice, I don't want to do the cheesy thing of saying, oh, Hadley's voice just came to me. But I had written a short story a year before I started working on this novel that was sort of an intense first-person voice of a movie star. And it was sort of a riff on Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes. And I really liked working with that voice. I don't usually write in the first person, so it's something different. And I liked sort of playing with these pop cultural kind of like touch points that the reader might already know something about. And so I'd been working on the book maybe just a month and had written some of the early stuff about Marion's infancy and about her parents. And then I wrote a Hadley section that on the surface had nothing to do with this book I was writing about a pilot. It just sort of was a first person bit about when Hadley cheats on her famous co-star boyfriend by leaving a nightclub with a pop star. And something about it just felt right to me and like it was the missing piece of this book. But I did do a lot of obsessing about should be present tense, should be past tense. There are these sections in the book called Incomplete Histories that are in present tense. And I did a lot of sort of trying to wrap my mind around if that was okay. I did try to write at various points Marion's entire logbook in first person and do that to render her flight instead of the way it is now, which is third person all toward the end of the book. It used to be sort of interstitial. So there was a lot of sort of structural and mechanical wrangling. And I would have these crises where I was like, should it be present tense, you know, about Marion's whole, the bulk of the book. And I'd sort of be in bed in the afternoon and, you know, ultimately you have to commit. And sometimes there's no one right way to do things. You just have to do what works and what you can move forward with.
Let's talk about your traveling a little bit, but in terms of travel writing, because this book's 600 pages is not your norm, especially like, you know, in a daily sense anymore anyway. So in addition to being a novelist, you're a travel writer. Where does fiction and travel writing overlap?
They're very different. And I, you know, you wouldn't know it since I was busy writing a 980 page manuscript at the same time, but I learned a lot about compression from magazine writing. And it's always, you know, on a travel assignment, I get sent to a place and then I have maybe 3,000 words tops to sort of get at the context of the place and why it's relevant now and what my experience was there and concrete details, sort of trying to bring it alive. So I think that's the biggest overlap, is trying to sort of create a sensory impression of a place. And it doesn't have to be through, you know, deeply detailed visual description. It could just be a sense. And so I think writing about a lot of different places and different kinds of places for magazines helped me when it came time to sort of write Marion's flight and to establish some of the places where she goes. And I also think just for me, having a broad range of experiences in different landscapes and different kinds of travel, that sort of context, I think, also informs the book, because I know sort of what makes different places unique, and, you know, what makes Svalbard different from Alaska, and what makes Antarctica different from anywhere else, and what makes Hawaii different from the Cook Islands, things like that. I think those little distinctions can be really important.
Well, you also wrote a modern love column, right, for the New York Times, speaking of Antarctica. I believe it was Antarctica that's featured in that one, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So let's talk about love, Maggie. at one point in the book, Marion is thinking about love, and she's sort of looking back at the people she's fallen in love with. And, you know, the reader is following her in that thought process. But you write, had Marion fallen in love right when they first met without even knowing it? And then you write that one character had taken her chin in her hand and studied her, and that she had fallen in love with another character who simply looked at her. You write, why did she respond so to being looked at? And, you know, in conjunction with this modern love column that you wrote for the New York Times, do you believe in love at first sight?
I think I do. Not so much in the context of that New York Times column, but I have experienced sort of, you know, the proverbial thunderbolt. I don't think that always means that something is permanent, but I think we are capable of just sudden deep attractions or having an instinct about someone. And I think for Marion, because she spends a lot of her life trying to sort of manipulate in some ways the way she's seen, to sort of control the way people respond to her, like in the section I read, you know, she's trying to look tough, she doesn't want to be approached, she's concerned about the attention she gets as sort of the rare woman in Alaska. And so for her, I think when she has a feeling of being really seen, and when she's vulnerable to that, it's a really powerful experience. And that's what sort of opens her up to the characters that you you mentioned in such a graceful, spoiler-free way alluded to.
Oh my gosh, I had to. What is your relationship to flying? Why write about a female pilot? And yeah, what is your relationship to flight and pilots and planes?
I didn't really have much of one before I started writing, and I've told this story a lot, but the sort of first idea I had to write about a female pilot was seeing the statue at the Auckland airport of Jean Batten, who flew from, was the first person to fly from the UK solo to New Zealand in 1936. And my brother was a pilot in the Air Force. He hasn't flown for a long time, but he was always someone who's just like obsessed with airplanes as a child and knew he must fly. And so it was always his thing. I just wasn't that interested in it. But I don't know what it was about the statue or the idea of writing about a female pilot that just like so clearly spoke to me. I think it's the ideas of adventure and freedom are so sort of inherent in that. And so, yeah, while I was writing, I mean, I thought about taking pilot's lessons and I just did not want to. And to me, that seemed like a persuasive reason not to. And I did fly in lots of odd planes. You know, if I could, I'd go flight seeing when I was traveling. So I've landed on glaciers and on ice, and I flew in a glider. My Missoula story is that I was at the aviation museum at the airport, and this was probably in 2015, and sort of poking around, and these two guys came and opened the big doors, and they started wheeling out this historic aircraft. And they were like, tell that lady, if she wants to come along, she can. And I was like, me? And so I went out, and they were taking up a 1927 Travelair 6000 and flew around the valley, and I got to go with them. And so that was the plane I had Marion learn to fly in, because I'd heard it and smelled it, and I had video of what exactly she would have seen from it. It was so serendipitous and so amazing. And then other things were like, on a magazine assignment, I flew in the back of a C-130, a cargo plane, to Greenland and landed on the Greenland ice sheet, which is where my sort of notion of what it's like to stand on the Antarctic ice sheet comes from, because the two things are indistinguishable. You're standing on thousands of feet of ice, you know, in this perfect white disc under the sky. I started to understand better just how flight changed the world, and so quickly. I became sort of more moved by how much aircraft opened up the world to people, and again, so quickly. So I think I feel a lot more about airplanes and flight and pilots than I did when I started the book, absolutely.
Hadley at one point reads a number of letters, and I'll leave the context of these letters a secret so that, you know, I'm not spoiling anything, but Hadley thinks to herself after reading these letters, reading those letters had felt good, exciting, and revelatory, almost like desire. And I'll just say that, like, Great Circle for me, like, I felt like that, and it's kind of like a book giddiness, wanting to know everything about a book's characters and narratives the way, you know, one might want to know a new lover. And so I'm wondering what books have made you feel this kind of desire, this book giddiness?
I love book giddiness. It's the best. Well, some of the books that sort of, I think, have sort of something in common with the spirit of Great Circle, I felt that way about. I really love Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. I remember buying it in the bookstore in Missoula, actually. And that's a book where the structure, she does something with it that I found really thrilling. And at the beginning, I was sort of skeptical. And then by the end, I was sort of elated. And I would say the same is true of A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. It has an interesting structure and a variety of voices that takes a little getting used to. And then by the end, I was sort of breathless about it. I love The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert. I loved Pachinko. One of the books that also I went back to again and again while writing this book was Veronica by Mary Gateskill. It's kind of a book that has some things in common with Hadley's sections. But yeah, I love to reread books. I think it's also in Great Circle. Hadley maybe says, yeah, I think it is Hadley says that people like narratives that have a little itch to them that sort of aren't perfectly satisfying. And I feel that way about Possession, by A.S. Byatt, which I mentioned earlier as well. It's a book that there are parts of it I'll just reread sections of forever, and then parts of it where I'll just never read them again. it's a book that for some reason just always feels a little bit unresolved to me, even though it does have a really coherent ending.
As a reader, you know, I don't think I actually realized how much I adored this book until I started writing questions for you. Like, I started realizing that there was so much there. And yeah, I really, really, truly love this book. I certainly have been changed by other books, or I have, you know, loved other books and, yeah, been changed by them. But I'm wondering, as the writer, did this book change you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think little by little, and in this sort of symbiotic way that I was going out into the world to sort of seek experiences that Marion would have, I sort of drew closer to the character, the idea of the character. I became more adventurous for sure. My comfort zone got sort of edged out and edged out and edged out as I sort of took more risks that paid off and that enlarged my life. So I feel, yeah, just the things I talk about and think about are so different than before I started this book. And some of that was also my first two books came out within 2 years of each other. So I had sort of 3 years where all I was doing was being in the book world and doing book stuff and caring about other authors. And, you know, this book was in some ways a huge step away from my professional life and just sort of this strange solitary toil that I had to live a lot of it also in order to write about it. So yeah, it absolutely changed me.
I feel like in what I do, I like rarely reread books anymore, but I'm excited to one day reread a book and one day reread Great Circle. Maggie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Look for more information about Maggie at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.